This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Potty Talks with Joseph Scott Moore. I don't know about y'all, but I think about temperature every day. And generally it has to do with determining how much money I'll have at the end of the month to pay for my air conditioning bill. Because I hate being in a, I'm not even going to say hot. I hate being in a warm house. I like being in a cool house. And unfortunately, my desire for physical comfort is non-compatible with summertime in the Deep South. I'm going to wind up having a huge electric bill at the end of every month, guaranteed. I think about temp in that sense. But you know, I thought about temp for a long time as a death investigator, because we use temperature in order to determine how long it's been since someone has, I don't know, been cast off this mortal coil, in the words of the bard. And there are a lot of indicators that we look for. And today on Body Bags, we're going to have a discussion about PMI, postmortem interval. And in particular, we're going to have a discussion that ties back to a case that is currently in the news and will be for months and months to come. The murder of the four students in Idaho. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave, I don't know if you recall this, but have you ever been around, and it's generally a grandparent, it doesn't matter if it is as hot as the surface of the sun outside, they're going to run the heat, they're going to put a shawl around them or a blanket.
Yeah,
they're going to have like woolen socks on. And a part of that is getting old. You know, you lose muscle mass.
Eddie Murphy did a funny bit about old people being cold. Why is it so cold in here? I'm freezing. I hope you don't know what time
it is. It's so cold in here.
I know, man, that's a memory.
I hadn't thought about that in years. What a great stand-up that was. It's so cold in here, baby.
But why is that? Because I had these two women that were sisters, and they were like the Snoop sisters back in the day on the Waltons. I think their combined age was 357. But I remember my mother-in-law was afraid something had happened to one of them and asked me to take her over there because they wouldn't answer the phone.
Yeah.
And as we got to the house, Joe, it was August in Alabama. So it was probably in the upper 90s, late afternoon. We were already sweating from the humidity, and I could hear their TV as we got to the door. They had it turned up very loud. And when my mother-in-law opened the door, just, you know, was knocking on it, and the door cracked open, I felt the heat hit me. I actually backed up the heat from the house, and I thought, oh, they're dead.
Yeah.
And they were in there, and they were bundled up, both of them. Both of them bundled up with the heat going, and it's 98 degrees outside. That was freaky to me.
Yeah, and it's probably equally as hot in that house.
Yeah, steaming.
Yeah, and it's terrifying on one level. Do you remember, and I know that you do, the summer, well over a decade. You remember that summer of horror they had in Chicago?
Oh, yeah.
Where it was so hot
that
the old people were dying in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew the chief ME at the time for Cook County, which is Chicago, what's his name? Dr. Ed Donahue, I think. Great forensic pathologist and a heck of a nice guy. I mean, just a really, really cool cat. And anyway, this happened right before he retired from Cook County.
Oh, wow.
Can see why this would be something that will push you over the edge.
Wow.
Because they had people that were dying left and right. And, you know, that's kind of a story for another day, but it's, you know, it's deaths related to hypothermia.
Hyperthermia,
yeah, as opposed to hypo.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to run with that, but I'm just curious now that you mentioned the old people and heat. Do they really, I mean, do as we age,
Yeah.
Do we feel colder? I mean, do they really feel cold?
I think the perception is right. I'm not a geriatric specialist, but
I'm becoming a geriatric. You'll have to.
You're qualified. I think that one of the things that occurs, first off, you're losing mass in your body. You know, your insulation is kind of dwindling away, fat layer, muscle layer. And in addition to that, you don't have the same robust circulatory system that you once had. And okay. So therefore you're going to feel cooler, or you'll feel like, you know, I know my grandmother always said she felt like she had a chill on her, you know, and that's wow. kind of a common theme, you know, that kind of runs through it as you get older. It hadn't hit me yet. I mean, I can tell you, I'll sit around and I'll be sweating and I'll look at Kim and I'll say, "Baby, what's the air conditioner on?" She'll say, 68. And I'll say, "Wow, it's really hot in here."
Yeah.
And she'll say, "Turn the fan up higher." And that's another thing. We can't sleep without a fan on. I'm addicted to it. I even use a fan. I use a fan app on my phone when I'm traveling. That's how addicted to fans I am. And it lasts literally for 10 hours.
You and I are going to end up in a daggone meeting one day going, "My name's Dave."
That's it. I'm addicted to. Hey, Dave.
All right. So postmortem interval. Now,
postmortem interval. It's you know, you hear this term is thrown around. I'm guilty of using it. I can't say guilty because it's an abbreviation, but you know, so it's PMI. You'll hear us use that term constantly, but it is postmortem interval. And the four big categories that we look at when we're trying to assess the dead, and that is going to be rigor mortis or rigor. It's pronounced both ways. We have postmortem lividity, which is also the term livor mortis. Then we have algor mortis, not to be confused with the former vice president, and it then we have gastric content. So you have four areas that are really kind of exploited by us in circles of death investigation to give us, you know, to try to do. And really what it is, Dave, it's a snapshot of time. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we go out and we try to do these assessments. Let me tell you this, and I'll say this right up front. This is kind of my, you know, word of warning here. None of this stuff is accurate to the point where you could bet your life on it. Okay. It's not a true quantitative measurement where you can say with precision, I'm talking about like Swiss watch precision, where you can say this is the exact moment in time when they took their last breath. That's mathematically, it's impossible to do that. You cannot do that. I actually went to, I'll never forget it. I was at a conference one time. By the way, I recommend highly that if you're interested in becoming a medical legal death investigator, the mother church of all medical legal death investigation is St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri, School of Medicine, Department of Forensic Pathology. There are four classes that are offered every year in intro to medical legal death investigation. I went through the class I finally got a spot in 1987. I'd been working for over 2 years by that time. And it is a rigorous program. You go for 5 days, it's 8 hours a day, and they dump knowledge into your brain in this place. Like you can't imagine, there's no breaks in here. So you're learning among the finest, you're learning from the finest at the medical school. And it was there that I first got, you know, really my intro in a class sense at St. Louis University to how do we determine, you know, how long someone has been dead. And there's a program called the master's program that's only offered like every other summer. And you have to have attended the basic course first. And I went to this thing and they had this guy from Germany And Dave, this is in the days, it wasn't a chalkboard, but he had a whiteboard up on the stage, and it wasn't one, it was three. And he had created a formula that extended over the surfaces of three whiteboards. And he claimed that he had the magic bullet to determining time of death. And I remember there were a bunch of us sitting there, and we're just kind of rolling our eyes. First off, no one has this much time. This is only something a university professor could do. When you're in tempo and you're out in the field and you've got a homicide that you're working, and you might have a suicide holding, a motor vehicle accident holding, you're going to glean as much information at the homicide as you possibly can. You got to move on to the next case. He had taken years to compile this data. And in a perfect world, you know, maybe it had some utility, maybe, but still to this day, they can't give you a specific time of death. So that's kind of my warning before we get into all of this. So if you ever come across someone that actually tells you that they can do it, that they can give you an exact time, run. Don't walk away from
that
person.
I really did think you could come within 15 minutes of knowing. I really did, until I talked to you about it, because I didn't know. I mean, you watch TV. Oh, well, yeah. I see he had a corn in his diarrhea. That means, you know.
Yeah, it's the best we can do. And I'd say the best I've ever been able to do, just looking at the numbers alone that we collect and the examination that we do at the scene, maybe 4 hours.
Wow.
Maybe 4 to 5. And
then you tie that in with the other timeline, right? I mean,
right. You have to. That's to the exclusion of circumstantial. You know, right. I last saw him at this time. Okay. I'm just talking about pure science now.
Right.
As pure as it can be in that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. So it's a non-controlled environment. And everything, and I mean, just about everything we're going to discuss right now is environmentally dependent. So I think that it's really important that we keep our wits about us and just understand that. So
that's fascinating. It's amazing that you have to truly know investigation beyond just the, like you mentioned, the guy uses three whiteboards to write a formula down to put this, to get it. And yet it actually does. There's more to it than just the nuts and bolts. You have to actually investigate the person's life to know about their death.
Yeah. And that lecture lasted for, it was like 2 hours and 45 minutes, and I wish I had that time back. It did demonstrate to me, however, that nobody really knows. I mean, nobody really knows. And, you know, I guess you could say, well, somebody's sitting in front of a clock, and this is an old example people have used before. I've heard it stated, and they're shot, and it's a through and through wound, and it hits the clock, and the clock stops. And so you marry that up with it. If you get to the body, it, you know, what is it they say? A broken clock is right twice a day. So even that has a caveat to it. But for me, I think starting off with rigidity, otherwise known as rigor mortis.
When does that happen, Joe?
Well, it begins, you know, you first begin to appreciate it pretty. It's not immediate. And this is kind of how it works. So if you think about the muscle groupings in your body, and I'm talking about like the tiny muscles that you even have, like that surround your eyelids, it happens everywhere. Okay. It happens simultaneously where you have this rigidity that begins to set in throughout the body. And a lot of people will say it starts in the small muscles of the body and extends out to larger ones. That's a fallacy. That's inaccurate. It starts everywhere simultaneously. However, it's most appreciated in the small muscles. And then the larger muscle groups are slower, you know, to kind of come around. So I'll give you a great example of this. You might not have rigidity, say, in the elbows, the wrist, maybe the shoulders, and certainly in the knees. But if you, and this is one of the things this is the first area I always go to check a body for rigidity, and that's the mouth. If I press down on the chin in order to try to open the mouth, and I'm struggling with it, this is what I know. That muscle grouping that is adjacent to where your jaw fits in, the mandible actually fits in to that joint, like the TMJ. When it goes in there, those muscle groups are most affected. They're tiny. Okay. So you get this rigidity that sets in the jaw. And yeah, people say you can appreciate it in the eyelids. I've never really seen that. I guess clinically they say you can, but for me as a practitioner out in the field, the jaw would be where I would go to first. And then it kind of extends out from there. You know, the smaller muscle groups, you'll see it, you know, like in the fingers, you know, or in the toes before you're going to see it in the ankles or the knees, or certainly in the hips. But what has occurred is that we are dependent, we are dependent in life on what's called cellular respiration. And so those cells are living, breathing, all right? When they begin to shut down, cellular respiration has ceased. And so the body generally, I'm not going to go into great detail, but there's a Krebs cycle and it throws off these little balls of energy, okay, ATP. Well, that ceases. Then you begin to produce ADP. And one of the products of ADP is actually lactic acid. So if you have ever worked out, if you've ever worked out in your life and you hadn't done it in a while and you wake up the next morning and you're stiff as a board, look, you can go take all the Motrin and Tylenol and aspirin and everything else you want to take, but sooner or later, that rigidity is going to leave your body. That's actually lactic acid buildup that you're experiencing in your joints. The reality is because we're upright and still breathing, our body metabolizes that, okay? The dead can't. They can't do it at the same rate that we do in life. Now, after a period of time, and this is one of the important things about rigidity, after a period of time, that lactic acid buildup in the dead begins to back out and it leaves. All right. So I think there's a common thought where people believe that, hey, you know what? We've heard this before. Once you're cold and stiff, man, you're cold and stiff. Well, no, you'll be cold, but you ain't gonna be stiff. Because that your arms, your legs, your hips, your jaw, everything becomes flaccid once again. You revert back. So you have to be there like Johnny on the spot. So what are you looking at relative to this? Well, it's first noticeable, the rigidity, the rigor mortis is first noticeable. It's going to take about 1 to 3 hours. A lot of it's going to be, first off, dependent upon the physiology of the person. And then it's also going to be dependent upon the ambient environmental temperature. And we always have to remember that anything that involves heat speeds things up. So it's going to take about 10 to 12 hours for it to be complete. So why is that important if we're death investigators? Well, it's very important because if I show up at a scene, Dave, and the body is completely rigid, like you can't move it, then I'm going to hazard a guess based on rigor mortis alone that person's been dead for 10 to 12 hours, perhaps. So my question is, going back to Idaho, I'm not being disrespectful here. It's a legitimate question. We have such a delay. And when those students were last known, allegedly, to have been alive, okay, the big number that everybody talks about is slightly after 4 a.m., roughly, okay, give or take, all right, going down until, you know, about half past the hour. That 911 call doesn't originate until like 11 something a.m.
It's almost 12. So,
yeah, almost 12. So, you know, you're looking at seven hours, I guess, roughly. And we you'd have to bracket that very carefully. I'm curious. This is dangerous ground here. I'm curious as to what the coroner saw, because she said in one report, Dave, that that these kids were obviously asleep when this happened. So my question, based upon that statement that she made in an interview, like within like 2 days, 2 or 3 days after this happened. So talk to me about rigidity. Did you measure rigidity? Because I don't know, you're telling me that everybody was obviously asleep. All right. Well, according to what we're hearing now, particularly based upon the Dateline dump that came out, these bodies were not in the position that we were led to believe. They certainly weren't tucked in their beds, you know, all snug in the bed. So for the medical legal authority, I would have to ask, what was the extent of your examination at the scene? Did you check for rigidity in the bodies? You know, was there stiffness in the jaw, stiffness in the limbs? You know, were the bodies flaccid still? Were they movable? And that's just on the point of rigor mortis alone. I think that that's a legitimate question that's going to come up in court. If the case goes off in August, which, you know, we're thinking it might, I don't know. I sit back and I think about that data and how it was collected at the scene. Was rigidity measured? Because, you know, my friends, I got to tell you, you can't measure the stuff at the morgue. The forensic pathologist, if you ever read an autopsy report, they'll say that when I received the body was cool to the touch. Rigor mortis was present in the jaw and the extremities. That's their boilerplate. And they'll talk about postmortem lividity. We'll get into that in a second. But you can't, that assessment at the morgue by the forensic pathologist, be honest with you, it ain't worth the gunpowder bullet to hell. Because that data really doesn't mean anything. The body has been taken out of context by that time. Dave, it's a 3-hour drive from Moscow to Ada County where these autopsies were done. And once the bodies are removed, they're going to go into a cooler. So that's going to affect the data. You can't. And then if there was air conditioning or no air conditioning running in the van, that's going to impact. Once you take those bodies out of that environment, if you don't do that assessment right then and there, at that moment, it's not worth doing. So that's, I think that's a legitimate question. The stiffness that you encounter with a human remain, it's shocking, you know, when you, and even for me as, you know, a guy that was involved in this field for a long time, it was shocking for me, you know, when I would, you still have an expectation when you're around the dead. I mean, obviously they're human. You still have an expectation they're going to respond to you like any other human. But the dead don't respond that way. There is a stiffness that they have that you don't encounter in any other context. You can even think about, say, for instance, if there's somebody resisting you and they're holding their arm, like you've grabbed them by their arm, and that resistance, they are still not the strength of rigor. It's quite striking. But here's another thing. You think about the changes in bodies relative to temperature. If any of you have ever lost a loved one, and in those last moments when you're at a funeral home or wherever it is, maybe you're sitting with a loved one and they pass on, there's something about the coolness of death. It's like no other type of sensory perception on your part, like the coolness of death. It's like you can, like if you go outside in the wintertime and your fingers are cold or your nose is cold, you've always got the friend that walks up to you and says, "Hey, feel this." And they put their hands on your face, you know, and you retract. There's something about the coolness of death. And that's one of the reasons, even in literature, you'll hear terms like the icy fingers of death. And it's a real thing. I mean, if you've ever been next to an open casket and you touch someone in there, there's something, it's the absence of any kind of life, I think. And when you're attempting to assess the dead based simply upon temperature, this is something that most people, I think, out there believe that this is our go-to. And for me, it's probably some of the most worthless data that exists. The reason is that there are too many variables involved, and no one can quite seem to come up with a methodology where they want to measure the temperature of a body. And let me give you an example. So you've got a real baseline here when you're talking about how cool or cold a body is, and you touch the body, and people will either say, well, the body is warm to the touch or cool to the touch. That's very baseline, very basic, right? Then you have other methodologies that are employed, like using a thermometer. Well, you run into a lot of problems using a thermometer, and here are a few. Many people will try to do what's called an axillary temperature, and that means that you take a glass thermometer and you place it in the armpit externally, and you place the arm against the armpit, holding the thermometer in place for about 5 minutes so you can get an accurate reading. And all the while, you have another thermometer hanging in the air, suspended in the air, taking the ambient environmental temperature. Now, you can either do that with an analog thermometer, like an old glass thermometer, mercury thermometer, or you can do a temperature reader in a room, which exists widely now. And you have to do this like every, I think it's like every, you do it in 20-minute intervals while you're at a scene to try to get an idea, if you can get an idea of how the temperature is dropping off on a body, but it's still wildly inaccurate. Now, there's a whole group of people out there in medical legal death investigation. Now, I'm about to blow your mind with what I'm going to tell you. They believe that it is good practice to take a human body at a scene. Remember, we have to do everything at the scene. You can't do it at the morgue. It's worthless data. And you take a scalpel, and you take a digital turkey thermometer, you make an incision beneath the last rib on the right side, which is that overlays your liver, which is the most dense organ in the body. And so you're looking for what's called, and you guys have heard this before, core body temperature. So once you make that incision, you take the thermometer and insert it into the liver, and it gives you a pretty instantaneous reading. But here's the problem with it. If that's your methodology you're going to employ, it doesn't matter what the case is. If you try to go to court with that, you better be doing it every damn time. So that means that, did you get a core temperature on the multiple stab wound victim? Just think about that just for a second. Let that seep into your groundwater. So you've got a body at a scene, a homicide, that's got multiple stab wounds. Now you're going to take a scalpel and make another incision into the body and then insert the thermometer? Oh, and by the way, this is what they tell you to do. After you've done this, take a Mark-a-Lot and make a circle around your incision and put your initials on it. And I remember the first time I was taught this, I was thinking, okay, so let me get this straight. You want me to open a body at a scene where I'm surrounded by not just police officers, but if I'm outside, which I have been before, surrounded by an angry group of people, and they see me whip out the cold steel and I'm kneeling over somebody's son in this environment, I'm to make an incision in front of this group of people and insert a digital thermometer? That's what you're asking me to do? Got it. Good idea. So, you know, the problem is that's your adopted practice. You have to do that every single time. You know, you can't say, well, I'm going to do it on some cases. I'm not going to do it on the others, because if you take that and that's your office adopted policy and you go into court with it, defense attorneys can potentially eat you up. They'll say, well, you did it on all these other cases. Why didn't you do it in this case? Isn't your data kind of invalid at this point? And you see how this can become a real problem. And plus, I don't know. I'm just not a fan of making incisions in dead bodies at the scene in an uncontrolled environment. And look, maybe that is very accurate, but I have to ask this question. And I don't know. Is the data that you're going to glean from that one procedure, is it worth compromising a case? It's kind of like, you know, for years there were people that said, oh, well, we need to do a rectal temperature at a scene on a dead body. Well, if that's going to be your office policy, what about rape cases? Are you going to take a foreign object at a suspected rape homicide case and do a rectal temperature at the scene? Because you're getting close to the core, kinda, and maybe the data is valid, but I think there's more important evidence that can be gleaned from, I don't know, the rectum.
Than be destroying vagina. Evidence along the you're way just, to get the temperature.
Absolutely. So is the data actually worth it? Now, let me run this down to you. So with about the first hour after death, you're going to lose about a degree and a half to 2 degrees of temp that's been generated in life. You're going to lose that temperature off the body after the first hour. Then for the next 12 hours, up to the 12th hour, you're losing 1 degree. Okay, so if you start off at 98.6, you can do the math from there. So when you get to that 12th hour after death, you've heard people say, well, you've assumed room temperature. That's kind of what it means. That means that you're, and I teach my classes at Jacksonville State this, mm-hmm. and it's kind of gruesome, I know, but it's reality. You're just like any other inanimate object that indwells that same space. So a piece of furniture, a desk, you know, a book bag, whatever it is, because the life that once existed within that shell of a person, you're no longer going back cellular respiration. Your body's not producing anything at that point. Okay. You are truly dead at that point. And so there's nothing coming off of the body as far as radiating heat or anything like that. So that can be, it can be a real problem. That's why my default position, I think pretty much throughout my career was always, yeah, they're warm to the touch. They're cool to the touch. But beyond that, what am I going to glean by, you know, what they're saying nowadays is kind of the industry standard of making an incision in a body and inserting. And this is happening. You know, people think, oh, come on, Morgan. No, it happens. It happens out there. There are people engaging in this practice. And I think it's foolhardy. It's reckless. It truly is, because I think that the data that is obtained from that particular procedure is not worth the risk of ruining an entire investigation. So, at the risk of being crass, if you've ever had a stomach virus at any point in time and you've had to go in to make an offering to the porcelain god, you have seen your stomach contents, okay? And it's not a lot different from what we see in the morgue. It's the only thing is that when you're kneeling before the porcelain god, you're not studying it. As a matter of fact, you're holding your head and you're thinking, God, please stop the room from spinning. Please, I promise I'll do whatever. I guess I'm talking about being drunk now. I guess I promise I'll never do this again. You know, you're making all these promises to God that I won't do this again. And if you've got a bug, it's horrible as well. You know, you're not thinking about necessarily what's coming out of you. You just know that it's coming out of you. And for us in medical legal death investigation, Dave, that's something that, as disgusting and gross as it sounds, that's something that we actually take our time trying to understand.
You know, I told you this before we started. when LaDonna's nephew was murdered, there was a question because he was giving a friend a ride home and, you know, attacked the victim kind of thing. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Talk about your innocent victim. He really was.
Yep, yep.
But because he was in his early 20s and he was out late, it was 2:30 in the morning. They wanted to know alcohol, drugs and stomach contents. Were there pills in there? What was going on? And what they found out was that there was no alcohol. There was no drug. There was no pills. They actually had the food that he had when he drove through Hardee's late at night and got a traditional meal because he was hungry. And that was one, as weird as it sounds, it was very comforting for the family because they had been put through all of this idea that somehow their dead nephew, their dead grandson deserved it, you know? And it was like he was giving a guy a ride home.
Right.
And talk about your innocent victim. But that was one thing. And they asked me about that. The family did later on about a number of things with the case. And it's something I told you too many times. People go through an entire case with a loved one who dies in a way other than natural. And there is so much going on. They don't get answers that years later mean something.
Yep.
You know, why did this happen or what does this mean? And I'm thankful I was able to answer those questions. Some I had to look up, a lot of them I knew, but still I got them those answers and it really did help. There was a grieving process that had continued for 15 years and I was able to help with that in the end. But, and I did want to actually mention something about Kathy Maybutt. That was the coroner in Idaho.
Yeah.
You mentioned it a few minutes ago and I went back and I pulled up my notes from what did we learn in the first 3 days? Because remember, she was all over the place.
Yeah. Jeff? Which I got to let me interject real quick and I'll shut my mouth.
No,
the,
buddy.
The thing, no. The thing about it is that's foreboding in my world.
Yes.
If you're a coroner or medical examiner, you know to keep your mouth shut. You're inside the investigative bubble. You take your cues from the police. Now, look, if you're an elected coroner, Godspeed. I mean, you can do what you want to do. All right. You're an independent.
And that's what this was, correct?
Oh yeah. Yeah. She's a nurse and an attorney.
Right.
And she got elected to the office of coroner, which is cool. I have no problem with that. However, if you're inside the investigative bubble, there's just certain things that we know that we don't, cause you still had killer on the loose at this point in time.
Right. We're talking so, 2 days after.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Joe,
yeah.
this is a summary. This is what I've got from it.
Yeah.
I was shocked. And I remember when we had this information of double checking because I thought this has got to be wrong. This has got to be internet rumor. You know, it can't be right because I've never heard this coming out of somebody's mouth this close to an investigation. Multiple stab wounds. She stated that each victim suffered multiple stab wounds, pretty extensive wounds. Actually, she described the wounds as pretty extensive. Said a large knife. The victims were likely attacked with a large knife. According to preliminary autopsy, some defensive wounds. At least one victim showed signs of defensive wounds, suggesting they may have woken up during the attack. Because if you remember, they were all attacked while they were sleeping.
Yeah,
that's what she said. Some defensive wounds, tears and big open gouges.
Not a term now, I would use, but
this is what Kayla Gonzalez's father said. Kathy Maybutt shared with him, described those wounds on his daughter as big open gouges and tears. Now, she also said that based on that, the murderer was pretty angry. He was a pretty angry attacker. They were killed in their beds. Now, we have actually heard a little bit different on this, but
there's a number of things floating around right now, and again it comes back from
the
dump that happened with Dateline, which we're still waiting to find out who leaked that information. It doesn't surprise me the news media ran with it, but it's just the fact that it's out there. And again, going back to the coroner's assessment, you can talk about, I guess, if you want to, tears and gouges, which is,
I wanted to ask you something that she did say, Joe, that I've got to ask you what it means.
Yeah. What's that?
She said there were no significant bruising. Now, we know that there is a 7-hour interval at least between the times of the murders and the time that 911 was called, at least 7 hours. Kathy Maybutt at the time said, she thought they might have been killed around 2 a.m. Now, they now have moved that time to after 4 a.m. before 4:30 a.m. before 4:20, actually. But
right.
No significant bruising, but there was a little bit of bruising, but nothing significant. Is that not an uncommon occurrence in you're seeing bodies at least seven. And by the time she got out there, it had to be even more than just seven. It had to have been closer to 10 hours by the time she got out there. She didn't get out there in the first 30 minutes or so.
No, I mean, I can't imagine. They would have locked the scene down. Police would have had a what's over. But if you remember as well, the DA showed up out there too. I'll never forget, you know, and apparently he had walked, the guy with the big beard.
Forgot about that.
He had walked through as well at some point in time. So I guess what it comes down to as far as the duties of the coroner and the assessment of these kids is how much data was collected at the scene relative to, you know, we had talked about rigidity.
Right.
We had talked about, body temperature. Do we even have an understanding as to whether or not the bodies were cool or warm to the touch? I think that's important. And then, you know, bringing it back to Zanna, what's the one thing here? And this isn't a trick question. What's the one thing that we know that Zanna was doing that was, she was one of the last things that she was reportedly doing relative to food?
DoorDash. She was eating.
DoorDash showed up. And, you know, one of my questions is, what kind of food was it? Was any of it consumed? And going back to earlier in the evening when Maddie and Kaylee had 140. Been out, you know, they went to the grub truck, right? So they're going to have food on board as well.
And would that be in their stomach contents? I mean, I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, yeah. So with generally we as humans, and this is heavily dependent upon whether or not we have some kind of gastrointestinal problem. You know, is our stomach and digestive system functioning normally? Okay. So that's the caveat to this. So it takes about 4 to 6 hours. 4 to 6 hours for the stomach to empty. So where does it empty? It empties into the small intestine. The small intestine is slower. And, you know, the small intestine, you know, you've heard these wild stories about how long the small intestine is. Well, the small intestine takes about 12 hours to eliminate. Okay. It's going to be, so if you block that and you say, well, what happened, you know, during this period of time? There's not a lot, you know, there's some appreciable evidence in the small intestine, but if you go back to the stomach and you have food remnant in the stomach, gastric content as referred to, when you open that stomach and when we take out the stomach at autopsy, you clip it at where essentially, I won't go into all the specific anatomical terms, but just think about where the esophagus coming down, descending out of the mouth, descends right before it gets to the stomach. You tie it off and you clip it. Okay. Then you clip the end of the stomach after tying it off where it's about to dump into the small intestine. So you can remove the stomach completely intact without spilling the contents. It's messy business. And most of the time we will take the stomach away from the body over to a sink, and we've got a pan. If you've ever seen, you know, when you go to a grocery store and you're going to put produce in a scale, that pan that you put produce in the scale with, that's what it looks like. We have those in the morgue. So we will have the stainless steel pan. We'll open the stomach in the pan and dump out the contents in there. And that way we don't lose anything, because I've worked with forensic pathologists in the morgue before that would literally open the stomach inside the cavity. Well, that's dangerous business, because if you don't dissect out the stomach and per the evisceration and you remove the stomach, if you just try to do it in there, the interior of the body or the cavity, okay, is very bloody stuff. You've got standing blood that's in there. So now you're going to commingle the stomach contents. Everything gets very confused. So it's best to take it out. And so if you have stomach content, you know that this person had eaten 4 to 6 hours roughly, because it takes that time for the stomach to clear. All right. Another thing that's dependent is if you drink a sports shake, okay, that ain't the same as going and eating a porterhouse steak and a baked potato. It's going to take a lot longer for that to pass through your system, okay? So you have to take that into account. But here's what's kind of interesting, Dave. You talked about this loved one of yours that had died, and he had gone, I think you said he'd gone to Hardee's, which, you know, serves these gigantic hamburgers, all right? Well, you know, when you open up the stomach, you can actually appreciate, people think they chew their food really well. They really don't. You can actually look, you can see ground beef. Pasta is one of the worst things. You can see spaghetti. You can make out what kind of noodles there are. Hot dogs are probably at the top of the list because they're encased. So you either have a natural casing, which is like an intestine, or you have one of these disgusting, I'm a big Nathan's hot dog fan. I love Nathan's because they have a natural casing. All right. I'm not a fan of like things that have, I won't name a brand, things that have synthetic casings on them. And so even with that, hot dogs will remain in place. You'll see that. Anything like grains, corn, rice, vegetables, broccoli, for instance, lettuce, it's not like you chew it up and it's gone. Generally, things like soups, those sorts of things, where the vegetables that are contained in there are cooked down. But there's a lot that you can recognize. And the reason I'm not saying this in order to disgust listeners, the reason I'm saying this is because there's valuable information contained in the stomach, particularly if you're talking about a drug OD. Maybe somebody has ingested something that was toxic. That's why when we remove the stomach, we'll actually get a very large plastic test tube and we'll collect the stomach contents and put a lid on it. And we actually submit that to the state crime lab because you can run tests on that. You can actually do toxicology off of that.
That's what I was going to ask you. How does alcohol play a factor in what is in your stomach? Like, is wine different than beer, and is whiskey different than wine? You know,
well,
does it play a part?
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is, this is kind of an interesting little aside. If you've ever been around somebody that had been, as my granddaddy used to say, pulling a cork the night before, the next morning, I don't care if they brushed their teeth, showered, shaved, put on aqua velva, high karate, English leather, pick your poison, or Giorgio. You can still smell the alcohol coming off their body. If you think that's intense around a living person, if you've got somebody that has been drinking the night before and they died like in a car crash, or maybe they got in a fight and they were hammered, you know, when you open the body, and I'm talking about not even opening the stomach, I'm just talking about the initial opening of the body, it like rushes out like a big gaseous fist and punches you right in the nose. You have that smell that like permeates everything. It's everywhere. And so the only way I can really describe it is that it's sickly sweet. It's got this sickly sweet odor to it. Much like, you know, the smell that comes off of somebody's body that's been drunk. They have that kind of sickly sweet smell. It's even more pronounced in the dead when you open the body. I used to work with a forensic pathologist. This guy's dead now. He was really, really old and very, listen, to say that forensic pathologists are eccentric is an insult to eccentric people because they are so, so eccentric. This guy used to claim, and he fancied himself a wine connoisseur. He was in New Orleans. So he'd go to all of these beautiful Creole restaurants and he would always sample wines. He used to claim that just by the odor, he could state what type of wine they had been drinking. I'm thinking, you're so full of it. You're so full of it. You can't do that. But for us, you know, in the morgue, the gastric content tells a lot about the activity of an individual. You know, we don't think about like passively, if we're eating either for nutrition or we're eating because of stress or whatever, we might pick up a handful of something. We're going to pop it in our mouth, or we just grab a quick something to eat. Well, you don't know if that ingestion of that thing is going to be the last thing you ever consume. And that's going to travel with you. So that's one of the reasons. And I, from a scientific standpoint, I value the information that I glean from gastric content, but probably out of all of the postmortem interval elements, it has to be postmortem lividity or livor mortis for me. And here's why. All of these other things are so, and particularly rigor mortis and algor mortis, which is body temperature, they're so heavily environmentally dependent, Dave. Livor mortis is not. So just imagine if you've got someone that dies sitting like the guy, you know, I showed you the image the other day when we did the first segment of this teaching series about decomposition, the guy that was seated in the chair. Well, the guy that was seated in the chair that died of an MI, just a natural death, had a heart attack. Based upon how he was seated, the blood, because it's no longer pumping through the body, is going to settle to the gravitationally dependent areas of his body. Gravity is like the one constant in the universe that kind of never changes. Now, if I had I've got an old friend that's an astrophysicist, probably one of the brightest people I've ever met in my life, as you can imagine. Country's butter, too. You wouldn't suspect. This guy's got a PhD in astrophysics from Clemson. I used to eat lunch with him. I just sit there amazed by this guy. He would dispute this with me because, you know, I'd say gravity's the one constant. It doesn't vary. He'd say, oh, well, if you go to the poles, it's different. You know, if you're on the equator, it's different. We understand what we're saying here. It's not as variable as temperature, all right? So if you're seated in a chair and you have somebody that passes away, the blood is going to settle, well, to the ankles, the feet. We'll actually see the feet swell. They'll turn purple. That's why it's called lividity. How many times have you ever heard somebody say they didn't have another adjective to describe how angry they were? And they said, I was livid, like that. Well, that's where we get this term, livor mortis. It's our postmortem lividity. It's that kind of purple coloration that comes on the body. And it's not a decompositional change, you know, where you'll see bodies that will go kind of purple and black and that sort of thing. It's not like that. This is the blood pooling. It goes first to the vessels, the capillary beds. They're not meant for storing blood. They're meant for moving blood. And those little beds burst. And when they burst, it leaches out into what's called the interstitial tissue, the kind of the fatty tissue that surrounds all the vessels, and it stains it. And dude, once it's gotten in there, you can't change it. So if you, like, for instance, we have cases where people will be killed in one location. The person might think about what are they going to do with the body. They'll crumple up the body after it's been laid on the floor for about an hour or 2 hours, and they'll put them in a trunk. Well, the first time they lay them on their left side, they've been laying on the left side where they were killed. They place them in the trunk laying on the right side. So you might have two presentations of postmortem lividity. And before it gets fixed, it can actually migrate around. And that's a real problem, you know, if you're trying to do an assessment. So it takes a measured point in time for postmortem lividity to fix. And once it's fixed and it stains the skin, it's not going to move. And so if you've got a body, if we come to a scene and we've got an individual that is lying in a prone position, which means their chest is in contact with the ground, and I show up at the scene and they're laying like that, but yet they've got postmortem lividity between their shoulder blades, I'm going to know that before I arrived, somebody moved that body. At one point in time, they were face up. And then all of a sudden, someone got the grand idea to either flip them or move them. You know, and this goes to scene staging as well. Well, going back to our four unfortunate students in Idaho, based upon the time frame of postmortem lividity, I can tell you this. Postmortem lividity is close to being completely fixed by the time the coroner shows up at the scene. That's how much of a lag time you've had. And the way we test it, and the way I would hope that she had tested it at the scene, is if you get one of these big purple lavacious areas, if you take your thumb on a gloved hand and you depress that area that's purple and it doesn't blanch, it still stays, that means it's fixed. That means that those little capillary beds have erupted and it's still, you know, it's no longer blanchable. Whereas you can get that staining, but if you press it and it blanches, that's called blanchable lividity. That means that it hasn't fixed yet. And so for both those instances, there's a measured amount of time that, you know, it takes for this to occur. So when we're looking, it'll be apparent, you can see it kind of pop up on the radar within 20 to 30 minutes after death. It's kind of like the kid that you saw I wasn't one of these kids that could do that, that you go to the playground with and they can hang upside down on the monkey bars and their head turns red and it kind of swells. Well, that's blood settling. Now it's still moving, but you know what I'm saying. So if within 20 to 30 minutes, you'll see the blood kind of pooling in these areas, and it's going to take, and intensity is going to increase up until about the 7th or 8th hour. And then it's there, it's not moving. So wouldn't that be an interesting set of data to have about the cases in Idaho? Was the lividity fixed? Were there multiple presentations of lividity? And I certainly hope that coming up in August, that all of these questions, there are many, but all of these questions that can be answered and that can be answered through science, and that assessment that hopefully took place on that day back in 2022 in November, I hope it was thorough. And I hope that we learn more about what happened that night. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.